Welcome to the For Love and Money podcast, the show where business and social purpose meet to inspire a movement for positive change. Here's your host, Carolyn Butler Madden.
My guest on this episode of the For Love and Money podcast is Kimberly Abbott. Now, Kim is CEO and founder of Vested, and this company has a mission that I love. It is to redefine millionaire to be a person who impacts millions of lives. Think about that for a moment. And what they do this through leveraging data-driven impact assessment to help people invest their money where it makes the best impact on society. Kim is an Aussie who has relocated to London, and I first learned about her when I was listening to another podcast, Mick Spears Leadership Project podcast. And I was so inspired by her story, I was just determined to get her on this podcast to share some of that story. It's taken about a year since I first listened to that other podcast, but here we are. So in this interview, Kim shares a bit of her journey from studying engineering to starting a social enterprise in India, to then going to work for a corporate, to then working for the UN. Assessing and monitoring peacekeeping missions. So she's had such an interesting path to where she is today and to then starting the company that she has now, Vested. And we get into some of the how Vested operates and how it differs from businesses that just report on companies' ESG, environmental, social and governance activity. And it's really interesting because they look at it through a very different lens rather than looking at it through what a company says it does. They look at how a business delivers impact through what it does and then through their other activities, but first and foremost through what it does. The key theme in this interview, though, is the purpose behind the business and how it has driven her to think ambitiously and basically create something of real value out of nothing. I feel absolutely inspired after talking to Kim in this interview, and I have no doubt it will inspire you and hopefully galvanize you to do something differently, whatever it is that you do. So I hope you really enjoyed this podcast interview. So, Kimberly Abbott, thank you for joining us on the For Love and Money podcast. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So, I can't wait to learn more about your company, Vested, because it looks so interesting and it looks like a business that is so fit for our times today. But before we get into it, I wanted to ask you, when you think about purpose-led business, when you think about business as it needs to be today to meet the challenges of our time, what role do you think love has to play in it, if any at all?
I think it's almost the key role, because when I think about purpose and businesses that, you know, when I often define purpose, it's businesses that solve the problems that we need solved. And I think the problems we care about are usually linked to who they help, and that's who we care about. So I think in a kind of business structure sense, I think love is absolutely important, but I think from a personal sense too, as a leader and the people that lead these businesses, I do it because of the love of my family and my friends around me. And I couldn't do it without that. So I actually think it's probably one of the not spoken about, but probably one of the most important factors into businesses that truly have a purpose and businesses that are led by people that have that purpose and can stick to it.
Yeah, that's really interesting, isn't it? Because it's the role, I guess it's the alignment of your personal purpose with the organizational purpose. And having an organizational purpose in itself, you know, that's such a driver of energy and innovation. But when you bring your personal purpose into that as well, I think it goes to a whole other level. So I'd love, Kim, if you can share your background story that led to where you are today with your business. And I I know from listening to another podcast, and I'm going to share the links to that podcast, Mixed Spheres, The Leadership Project. Kim appeared on two episodes, actually, back to back. And that's how I got to know about Kim. And I was so inspired by her story that I wanted to get her on here. So if you could share some of that background, because it's really, I get the feeling it's really shaped what you're doing now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think when I get into it in a second, my background may seem quite disconnected, but I actually think it is all underpinned by kind of problem solving and purpose. But I am Australian, even though my accent doesn't give me away anymore. But I was born and bred down on the New South Wales South Coast. I'm an engineer by background. And it was actually when I was at university that I founded an award-winning social enterprise in India. And that was my first kind of baptism of fire into social business. I didn't start a charity. I had actually just read and learned a lot about UNIS social business. So I understood the concept of purpose and profit and decided when I was there. So the social business was around economic empowerment of women. And it was, how do we help these people and give them a hand up, not a hand out? Because that was actually what they wanted. They wanted to be empowered. And how could we do it in a way that was self-sustaining? So business was the answer. So I did that for a few years, ran that from Australia. It was all kind of run with partnership with universities and a foundation in Australia. Then I sold my soul, as I say, to the corporate world for a few years. Which was what led me to the UK and living in London. And then after a few years there, I got the itch, I say, which is that once I think you've been involved in a purpose-led business, it's really hard to go back to businesses that, to me, basically, I was doing a job that I loved for a big engineering company, but it didn't feel like I was solving problems that mattered. That mattered to me. And I think that caveat is important because what matters to each of us is different. Some people could find purpose in what they were doing every day, but I couldn't. So I left. I didn't have anything really lined up. I just went, I want to go back to solving problems and using my time and skills every day, solve problems that matter. And I ended up working for the United Nations for many years. So I was hired by the UN to build for them a data platform to assess and monitor the impact of peacekeeping operations globally. So wow. 13 conflict zones in the world, peacekeeping missions. And like most, you know, organizations you see these days, they have to evidence, you know, what is the impact? What is the change they're actually creating? So it was one of the most interesting and also one of the most challenging jobs I think I've ever had, which was traveling around the world to conflict zones for 4 years, rolling out a data platform. But it is the kind of second bit that led me to going, the problem we were solving was, you know, how do we understand the impact of the $8 billion that the UN spends on peacekeeping? And I thought, if we can do this on $8 billion, the world is actually short about $5 trillion a year of enough money to solve all the world's problems, poverty, climate, you know, inequalities. So if we could take this same, you know, approach to understanding the impact of money and apply it to the private sector, we could truly use business to change the world. And in fact, it might be not just the best chance we have, but the only chance we have to drive enough money into solving the social and environmental issues we face. So that was where my company Vested kind of was spawned from. To go, how do we measure and quantify the impact that companies have outwardly, not looking at what is the risk of climate on a company, but what is the impact of a company on climate, for example, so we can move money into the companies that genuinely are solving the problems that we face today. So that's the quick journey through it all and where we are now.
And it is a really quick journey into it. And it's kind of like, okay, India, how did you end up starting a social enterprise in India and then, you know, exiting that and going into the corporate world. I can sense stories littered through this journey, and they must be pretty big stories. Was there any one pivotal moment? I mean, I guess you've just described that pivotal moment of the UN. And so you're a software engineer, are you? Is that your background?
I'm actually a mechanical engineer by background. So I grew up with a farming family. I studied mechanical engineering because I liked to build things. And I actually wanted to be a biomedical engineer. So I did my engineering kind of internship with Cochlear, the great Australian innovation of the cochlear implant. And that I think is those moments in life where you think you have it planned out. I was so certain I was going to be a biomedical engineer. It's what I wanted to do. I did my thesis at university on helping with the world's most advanced artificial heart. And then I ended up in India. And how I ended up there was my university gave me a grant to go and volunteer one university break, semester break, to teach English. And it was actually when I was there teaching English that I went, this isn't really solving the problem that we see. How is there a better way to do this? And it kind of just catalyzed, I think. It's still, to me, it was still engineering and problem solving. It was just a different application of it. And I say that even though I ended up in software, it was still a concept of solving problems that I believe my engineering degree put me in a good position to do. But yeah, I'm a self-taught coder, so to speak.
That's so interesting. And the engineering side, the mechanical side, the analytical side, that's the how. I'm curious, what set you on the path to solving societal problems? Was it instilled in you from your family, or, you know, was there a moment, or is it simply generational? You know, you're young, your generation is facing, you know, huge problems.
I think it's a factor of all those things, actually, Caroline, because people ask me a little bit about what I did in India, actually, even, because I think that was kind of 7 years ago now. The narrative around social issues was very different. It wasn't as prevalent as we see now. But I think for me, when you talked about family, something that was instilled in me and I think was really important was failure wasn't seen as the kind of antithesis to success. Like, failure was totally seen as fine in my family. I spent most of my formative years watching my father tinker in the shed. He believed kind of anything could be fixed. And if it wasn't fixed, it was like, oh, well, I tried. And I look now and I think that gave me the courage to try, because it wasn't about, most of us don't try because we're scared that it's not perfect or we're going to fail. So that, I think, gave me the kind of thing to at least try. I think the reason, I think, love, when you talked about love, I cared about those people in those villages in India. I cared about those women, which was then, you know, well, I really want to do something to help. And yeah, it was then the support of the people around me. People thought I was crazy, and maybe I was to a degree. You have to be careful sometimes. You go into these countries with your kind of white savior complex to a degree. And it was the love of my family, who my mother still says, actually, she was slightly terrified that I was going to throw away my engineering degree and run off and live a hippie life in India. But she kind of didn't tell me that till after, because it was that love and support that made me think I could. When you talk about the how and the what and the why, you know, the why was I cared about the women. The how was because I'd been taught that failure, you just try. And then the kind of the what was that I had the people around me to help me navigate something I had never done. I'd never run a business, let alone set one up on another country, you know, continent. But yeah, I think that to me was what, when I reflect now, is the reason I was able to do what I did.
That's gold. I think that philosophy around failure is a gift, you know, a gift from your family, because so many people don't think that way. And, you know, if you think failure is just, you know, evidence that you're trying something new, and it's part of the journey, But also I wonder, and I say this because I think it's actually beneficial to this kind of journey, but perhaps a dose of naivety.
I think ignorance is bliss to a degree, definitely. I think when you said the youth naivety thing, I'm not sure I would, if I went back to India today, if I would do what I did, because I think actually I know so much now that I would have convinced myself it wasn't going to be possible. It wasn't, you know, so I think absolutely naivety. I thought I could, so I did. And I think it was similar in my UN story, because I went into the UN. UN is a policy institution by and large. It has some of the smartest policy and international law people you will find. They have hardly any tech people. So I kind of went in there as the expert in my field, but not knowing their world, and kind of thinking, yeah, I can build a data platform that works in 13 of the, you know, worst conflict zones on earth. That can adapt to the different issues. The issues in Kosovo, which is still a peacekeeping mission, is very different to Mali, which is different to, you know, Congo even. But I was that naivety of just going, yeah, this can be done. And it was almost the longer these things went on, the more the crushing reality hits. But it's the naivety that gets you started and lights the fire, I think.
And that naivety, Kim, I think is actually vital in the world we live in today, because there is so much happening. We're jumping from one crisis to the next. There's so much unknown. We don't even know what the world looks like in 5 years' time, in 3 years' time, heck, you know, with AI, we really don't know. So, you know, the generation going to university now, it's kind of like, you've got to be ready to try new things. You've got to be ready to fail on your path to success, not to give up when you fail, but just accept it as, well, I failed here, but I learned this, because we need new solutions, and the solutions that have served us in the past have brought us to a position where we actually need to change the way we think. So I think that dose of failure is acceptable, and naivety is healthy, is something that I think we really need a lot more of.
Yeah, I just very quickly on that, I was talking to some engineering students last week, and I actually said to them, it's about picking a problem to solve so important that even when and if you do fail, the world is still better off with you having tried. Mm. And they kind of look at me and being like, why are you mentioning failure in that sentence? But it's like the reality, particularly with a startup, is 9 out of 10 will fail. But pick that problem, to your point. Be naive enough to go, I can make change the world, because like the saying, you know, shoot for the stars, you shoot for the moon, and even if you miss, you'll land upon the stars, because there will be something gained if you pick a problem, you know, worth solving. So yeah, that's the kind of phrase I now say to the students, to kind of say, don't tell me what job you want to do, tell me what problem you want to solve, and tell me why it's so important that simply having a go is going to be, you know, value in itself.
Yeah, brilliant. And it goes to being able to be ambitious, to dream big, and actually think it is possible, the changes we need to create. So I want to come back to you at the UN and taking what you learned through that role into starting Vested. So take us there. How did you go about? Well, first of all, tell us what Vested is. What is the mission of the business? What is the purpose of the business? And how are you delivering on it?
So Vested was started with a goal to redefine millionaire, to be a person who impacts millions of lives. And the whole concept of that was, how can we create a new sense of value, a new way to value what we do? Because risk and return in the investment world is what's looked at. But what if we looked at risk, return, and impact? So that was kind of why and the goal Vested sets out to solve. What it is, so we are a data company. It's a data platform where we pull in data about companies. We then apply over 200 million academic articles, which helps us understand kind of what companies do and what issues that solves. And then we pull on over 100 million impact data points, which is data from the UN, the World Bank, the OECD. It's the data that tells us what's needed in the world, what's happening in the world. And we're basically linking all that together in an algorithm that says, if we know companies are doing X, Y, Z in these places, how is that really serving the needs of those people in those places, first and foremost? Is it what we need? And how much change is it creating? So that's what it is. It's a data set. All that happens in the space of 20 seconds for a company. And we have the data on kind of 30,000 companies in the world. It grows every day, but it was built to help banks and, you know, companies to get a better understanding of, are they truly delivering and building products and services to solve the problem we have, so that they can make better decisions about where they put our money, really, when we put our money in a superannuation or our pension. So based on that, they decide where it goes. So if we can give them the data, they used to say, we can't make those decisions because we don't have the data on impact. And I went, well, if I give you the data on impact, can we make better decisions? So that's kind of what it does and why it was started.
And that's, so I read something on your website that was really interesting to me, because it said something about it's different to other companies that actually measure the ESG metrics of companies. And ESG metrics, you know, I think the shine is coming off ESG in some countries, and it's about what the company reports itself. So tell us a bit about that, because there's a big difference there.
Yeah, so for those that aren't aware, you may have heard, you know, kind of ESG, which is environmental, social and governance factors, which has been for the last decade, even more really, the way we've looked at companies. But the thing with ESG that most people don't realize, so it is a risk tool. So it is not a bad tool. It's just not built for the purpose we're looking to use it today. So ESG is a risk-based assessment, really, of what is the impact of the environment, of how is climate going to affect the value of a company? How is, you know, maybe water crises going to affect the company? So it looks outward in. What is the impact of social issues, of social regulations? So a company that scores low on the S on ESG, it's usually because they don't have good employment law, they don't pay their staff well, but it's because it's seen as a risk to the value of the company. It's not looking at the flip side, which is what we do at Vested, which is, well, what is the impact of the company, of what they do, really on the issues that matter to us? Now, most people don't realize that ESG measures that. And that's, I think, that's the fault of banks and people not explaining properly what these numbers really were. But it was also that this was a metric built based to assess risk. It was never constructed to measure the latter.
And compliance. It's very much got a compliance mindset
It's a tick the box. It's a tick the box, absolutely. You know, can you, do you pay your staff well? Do you have health insurance for your staff? Do you have this? But it's not looking at how impactful, like if you're Apple, how impactful actually is delivering a mobile phone? To who? That mobile phone has a different impact in Uganda than it does in the United Kingdom, and that matters, right? And that's the questions that aren't asked. And so that's what we set to ask, to go, if you care about companies that behave well, ESG is for you. If you care about companies that do well, then you need to consider impact and that. So, and it's a tough narrative to distinguish for people, but it's an important one. And the good thing we're seeing is, you know, a lot of the financial institutions, they understand that. They do, and they want to do better, but they do what their clients, people listening, everyday people care about. So if you care about the latter, you know, you need to ask for that. And now they'll find that information and they'll start to look at that, as opposed to looking at what companies are most at risk, you know, to their bottom line climate, as opposed to actually helping it.
And so when did you start Vested?
Actually, I started it in 2019. So I started it whilst I was still working at the UN. And yeah, I kind of part time. I built the first 2 years of the company was basically me building the algorithm and the system myself. I now have an excellent tech guy who is far better at me. The first versions of the platform were hanging on by a thread, let's just say. But I also believe in, you know, when I talked about, we talked about failing, it is about to just doing things quick. They don't have to be perfect. Get it working, show people, make sure that it's needed, that it solves the right problem, and then you can invest the money and the people in then, you know, getting it right. So yeah, we've been running for about 4 years. We've only been in market, so selling the data and the product for about 18 months, 12 months. And it's been really interesting. It's been exponential because 4 years ago when I started Vested, I would talk to banks and they would really laughed me out the door because they were like, we just care about ESG. Yes, we understand impact and we know it's important, but it's that's a 5 year problem. That's a, you know, this. I had one CEO of a bank say that to me last year. She said, this is great, Kim, but this is a 5 year problem. Within a year, they'd come back to me and said, okay, we get it. This is a now problem. So I think we have seen that change of, you know, people do care. People care. And now the institutions around them are letting them care, which is what's seen a drive for us.
And so this comes under ethical investing, doesn't it?
To a degree, yeah. It sits more in what you would class impact investing, probably. Yeah. There's different phases in it, but we do look at human rights. We do look at, so like I said, there's how companies, do they behave well and do they do well? We are doing do they do well? The behave well sometimes fits a little bit more in ethical, but they all cross over and they all interlinked. And I think that's important to recognize too.
Yeah, really, really interesting. And I can't get my head around, is this all like AI driven?
It's actually not. We use very little AI. It's think of it as just huge databases. So the AI is used on the academic articles. Because if you think, if you're a university student at the moment or in the last few years, the technology used to screen if you've plagiarized your documents, right? Very similar technology we use, right? It can scan these academic articles, that is AI, and determine basically like, you know, words and causal kind of things. So that's how it helps us to go, okay, how do we know that a mobile phone has impact on access to internet or access to mobile banking? It's not my opinion, it's scientific evidence, and here's it all. So that is AI driven. But the 100 million data points we pull in quite literally was probably 2 years of me mapping, you know, 40,000 indicators against what they help, because that becomes just a huge big data problem of it knows then if it's a phone and a mobile phone helps access to mobile banking, then we have the data that says how many people do use mobile banking, what is the percentage of people that are underbanked in the world, what are the percentage of people that even have access to a phone, and that's where those indicators are all pulled in. That helps to then understand, do they need, is this helping the right people with problems that are important? And is it actually creating change? Because we have the trends of those data. So we're trying to use, I know ChatGPT is big at the moment and topical. We've started to test that only to summarize our data in a sense that we produce for any one company about 8 pages of data on what they impact, where, how much, all the data, which is quite a lot for a person who's not a data person to read and understand. So we've trained our own GPT model. So we're basically feeding it our data and our reports to say, summarize this. So not the chat GPT you see that summarizes the internet, but our own little kind of microcosm that says, summarize only given the information that's here. You mentioned earlier, Caroline, about not taking the information that companies say they do. So we have to kind of screen that out and partition everything off. So we don't use a hell of a lot of AI, but it does help to speed up some of the things. We use what's called more so supervised machine learning, which means we have trained it, we continue to train it. It only ever does what we tell it to do.
Enjoying the podcast? If you're looking for more inspiration, head to our website, thecauseeffect.com.au.
for more resources on how you can start using your business as a force for good. Or buy the For Love and Money book. Every copy sold allows us to protect 1 square meter of rainforest. Help us save 10,000 square meters by 2025.
I was reading about your Vested's impact algorithm, and I really like the way it talks about how it seeks to answer 4 key questions about companies. Can you take us through that? Because I think that will really give clarity to people about how you operate.
So the 4 key questions actually weren't so much designed by me. They came from a framework called the Impact Management Project. But when we look at a company, we look at, are they serving the people that most need what they have to offer? So mobile phone, again, is an example. Who really needs one? If you're building mobile phones, I mean, everyone in Australia probably nearly has one, but who needs them and the problems they address? The second question is, how important is the problems that this company's products and services solve? This is quite a challenging question if you think about it, because climate is globally important. But if we're looking at people on the ground in London, the data we have is affordable housing is the number one issue most important to people. So we take those factors into account. You know, what's a globally important problem? What's the problem that we have survey data that actually matters to people? Because if you're solving the needs that they have the most, chances are your impact is going to be greatest. But it's also a bit like a Maslow's hierarchy of need, particularly when we look at Africa and emerging markets. If you have not got basic health, basic security, you know, basic services, anything you put on top of that's probably not actually going to help. The third question is, what is the value? So how much do these products then move the needle? Because we can say a mobile phone helps with access to internet, but how much? How much so? And that's what that question kind of answers in terms of immediate, in terms of long-term, all those things. So things like health and education really shine in that because the impact is long. And then finally, the very last question we ask is, well, how much? How much of it? How big is the change you're creating? And this very much does have to do with the size of the company. Because, you know, as much as we can have great small social enterprises that solve an amazing problem really well, we do need these problems solved at scale. So we do then look at how much change are they creating. But it helps to answer the question, too, of how much change could they create? The idea being then, if you have a company that ticks the first 3 boxes well, the last one is the simple case for investment. If you're a bank, we say to them, look for someone that hits those first 3 well, that doesn't hit the last one well, because that just means they need your money to scale and, you know, you're solving really good businesses. So that's our 4 pillars, really, that all that data and everything revolves around.
And then what's the role of returns for the investor in that?
Yeah. So
love and money.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we can't ignore that and be naive about that either, because the reason you invest your money is to get a return first and foremost, particularly when it comes to things like pensions and superannuation. I'll be the first to admit, I do not want my super to go down. So that is where the research now shows that it isn't a trade-off between impact and return, but it does need to be considered. So when I talked about why Vested was created to put impact alongside risk and return, that's the message. It is one factor. It's one factor in the decision making. You might care about that factor a lot. That is up to the person. So when we talk about AI and decision making, our system does not make a decision. And that's important because there are other factors that should be considered. Risk, your life circumstance, return, exactly that. Do you need the money back now? Can you wait 5 years? Are you happy just to get an equal return or more? So that is actually why when we built Vested, I originally built it as a platform that would be accessible to anybody. But we changed that, and that we only sell the data now to banks, to your financial advisors, to investors, because actually there is a responsibility there that those other factors must be considered. And we're aware of that. And I believe, you know, particularly at the moment in the economic times we're in, you know, simply giving people one number and going, you should put all your money in these companies just because they're great. Economic growth, poverty are all important problems that we could be hindering if we're not responsible with how we promote our data. So yes, I think return is, it just weigh those three up together, basically risk, return, impact. And to me, then you can make considered decisions about what trade-offs you want to make, if you want to make them, in terms of other factors in your life and the world.
And so I'm really interested, you mentioned that when you provide a company with a report, it's 8 pages of data. So you also report to the companies who you're reporting on?
No, not actively, no. So if a company reaches out to us, so a lot of startups do this, because when we talked about ESG earlier, obviously, the big financial markets only ever look at the big companies. They only cover usually around 2,000 companies, because they think that's all anyone cares about is Apple, Amazon, and whatnot. Which means small companies who do fantastic work never get kind of shown off on these rankings and that. So the most companies that reach out to us are actually small companies, startups, social enterprises who say, we know we have a good impact, we just need the evidence. So companies can reach out to us, and we can either, if we've already got the report, they can have it, or we can run their report, which, like I said, takes seconds usually. So, but by and large, we don't engage with the companies because, A, as I mentioned, we don't take in the data of what they say they do. We're very objectively a kind of screening for what they deliver and where. We don't take on all their fancy reports that, you know, go, oh, but we give to this charity.
God, people would hate that.
they do. And then, to be fair, we do have to consider sometimes, because what we are assessing is the products and services of a business, you know, so fashion is a great one. We basically are assessing how important are clothes. We are not assessing, though, are they, though, giving, you know, their profits to charity? Are they doing lots of stuff with their stuff? We're kind of not looking at that yet, because we're looking at that fundamental purpose of is the company designed to solve the problems, which does sometimes miss the great value that some of these companies add as their add-on, which can be, we're trying to discourage kind of add-on, like build good businesses by design to solve problems. But some of them probably have a right to be a little bit like, well, but, you know, let's be honest, we need clothes. They don't really solve a problem, but we can't all walk around without them. So how can we offset that? And that's a challenge we're tackling at the moment, to try and make sure we can kind of capture some of that offsetting that they may do, but it's still seen as to us as slightly lesser than a by design products and services that solve the problems.
And it's really interesting, isn't it? Because it's, I guess, you know, for the last few decades, we've had businesses where it's almost thoughtless. It's just, you know, people go, yeah, we're going to become an accountant, or we're going to go into finance, or we're going to whatever it is. It is, these are the categories that exist. These are the industries that exist. We're solving these problems, but there are so many businesses solving those problems in different ways. And yet here we have, you know, through the UN Global Goals and beyond, here we have real problems that need solving. And it just seems a little lazy that, you know, because it's not obvious what the profitable solution to this is, most people don't go there. And yet, I guess what you are doing in your reporting is showing the value of the businesses that are doing that. So I absolutely love it. I read somewhere, I think it's been reported quite a lot now, that the global goals represent a $12 trillion US dollars market value opportunity. And so much of that is going untapped.
Yeah.
So you're right in the global south.
Yeah, particularly in the global south and emerging markets. It's just, to me, it is just, it's booming, and for innovation, for opportunity. And there are some, and what I think is interesting to your point, Caroline, about what our data shows is, when a company or someone sees, because it ranks companies in that as well, and they'll go, well, why are they better? And they might see, it might be like, well, actually, Standard Chartered Bank, fantastic bank that banks Africa. That's kind of their kind of motto. They're a British bank, but they bank Africa, they bank Asia, Latin America. And they went where no one else would go because everyone was like, there's no money there. And they do really well. And so when other companies see that and they go, but hang on a second, but they're still profitable, they're still making money, yet they're super impactful, we can do that too. And I think the same case goes, I'll use the finance sector again, in some of these SDGs and these sustainable development goals take the smallest of tweak to solve. Like inequalities and access to finance for women and the gap between that, to me is such a small change for these banks and financial institutions to just design the products that they better meet the needs of women. And some of the financial institutions that we have seen that are doing it and doing it well, you kind of, like some of them, you would look at them and they're actually some of the most profitable banks because they are proving, to your point, Caroline, that you can make money and make a difference. And actually, like they say, solving the UBS, the very traditional old Swiss bank, they have fantastic work on closing the gender financing gap, gender wealth gap, because they actually said, this isn't a feel good. This is quite literally a business proposition. Women are the most underserved and underbanked. And actually it's 51% of the world's population. We get this right. We're doing well. They just bought Credit Suisse. I mean, there's no more signal of doing well as a bank from solving the problem. And I think others look to things like that.
It's so that's what I think. Such a big opportunity. Yeah, I love that. And I remember, so I wrote in my book, one of the case studies I shared was PayPal and how they've got this huge target of 1 billion customers, I think it is. And it forced them to look at underserved communities. So they said most financial institutions serve, you know, the middle class to the upper class, but it forced them to go, okay, let's look at underserved communities. Let's look at Black owned businesses and female owned businesses and all of that sort of stuff. And the more they raise up people, mm-hmm. you know, the more profitable it is for them. It's a win-win-win for everybody. So it's that sort of philosophy, isn't it?
Yeah, to your point of not doing things the way they've always been done, and just because sometimes when you say to people, why don't you, to your exact point, why don't you serve small businesses? Why don't you serve Africa? They can't often answer because it is simply, well, we just haven't. We just don't. And just asking that question alone is enough to make people go, well, hang on a second. Maybe we could. Maybe we could solve these problems. You know, when we say you're investing the money anyway, why not just, you know, if you can get the same return and the same risk profile, but it's a company that's having a better impact, why wouldn't you? And they generally go, no, we don't have a good answer to why we wouldn't. And you know, and I think it's just challenging the way things have always been done.
Yeah. Amazing. And so Vested now is hitting its stride.
Yeah, we're starting to, we've had a big year kind of last year. We got, you know, we kind of started picking up more customers. The more people, our impact is driven by how much money we help redirect. Because actually, we don't change the world. We say that, like money doesn't change the world. The people who spend it do.
Yeah.
We're simply giving the data to empower others to make these decisions. So the more customers, the more people that use our data, the more companies that we can show the impact on is kind of our metrics for impact. So we're growing. We've got people like the UN use our data, big banks, big consultancies. But also last year, the Paris Peace Forum, which is, you have COP for climate. Everyone knows about COP. The World Economic Forum is the global forum on the economy. Paris Peace Forum is the world's kind of yearly conference on security and peace. And what's really interesting is it used to be about the development world, but it's now actually the private sector is seen as a key driver because, you know, businesses and the economy is key to peace and security in many of these places. And we were picked as one of four companies globally and the only private sector company picked to present at the forum to 32 world leaders on the impact, on how do we measure the impact of private companies. So I think the world is shifting. I think the world has always cared. We've just never let them put impact alongside their money. But it's great for us as well. I think it's showing that after all those years of, you know, believing we were solving a problem, people are starting to believe in it with us.
That gives us massive recognition. Congratulations on that. That's amazing. Do you have many competitors offering what you do?
Look, there's many people that work in this space of going beyond ESG. Not many do it. No one does it kind of the way we do, which is to quantify impact. A lot of them will say, oh, well, this company is aligned to these SDGs. You know, maybe if you are a bank, you're like 70% aligned to poverty just because you sell financial products. But we do that next step of kind of going, but how much are you actually, what is the degree you're solving the problem? And no one uses all the external data points like we have. But I think the wonderful thing I find about the competitors in our space and the people in this space, we often don't see each other as competitors. It's almost collaborators, because I think we all know, we go back to naivety. Like when I started Vested, I kind of wasn't naive enough to think that I alone could solve all the world's problems. But it is about finding the part we're good at and collaborating with the other people that are good. One of my good, there's a great New Zealand company that's doing amazing here in London and globally. And they do carbon emissions data. They do it better than anyone I've seen. They're called Kogo. And instead of us trying to like compete on that data, it's like we can, you know, we work with them. We can tell other companies, use them. If you want that part done right, use them. Use us if you want this part. And that's one of the most, I think, encouraging things in this space is the willingness of people to just solve the problems.
Yeah.
You know, we can work together on it. It's not competition between us. It is about collaboration, because this ultimately, all of this isn't about us. It's about the world and the problems it has.
Tell me, Kim, what do you hope you can achieve with Vested?
I mean, our big goal, as I said, about redefining millionaire is to redirect, you know, at least $5 trillion into companies that are genuinely contributing to and solving the world's problems. That's our big lofty goal, and that's what I'd like to achieve. And I think, you know, anything, when I said earlier about, you know, what, even if you fail, you know, is it important enough to try? And I think even the change that we've helped drive to people thinking this way, even if we don't get to 3 trillion and we only redirect, you know, 1 trillion or half a billion, that is still so many human lives. And that's what it's about in the end. This is about bettering the lives of people. We've talked a lot about investments, a lot about financial institutions, which are just four walls. It's the people inside them, the people that are impacted by these companies and what they deliver. We are aiming as big as we can get, and we get that big by working with big banks and with people. But I think already, to me, if it ended tomorrow, I would still say that this has been a success to a degree, or certainly not a failure.
Absolutely, 100%. And the change you've already created and the money you've already redirected and the lives you've already impacted in that process, plus the people you've inspired to actually do something themselves, that counts for a lot as well. I love that you bring it back to it's about human lives, because, you know, isn't or shouldn't business be about that? At the end of the day, it's taken on this whole value in itself, and we've got to feed the machine. But ultimately, you know, isn't it about how it started in the first place to serve people and society, not the other way around? So I just love what you're doing with this business. We are going to need to wrap up, and I want to, there are two levels that I'm thinking about that I'd love to get your thoughts on. One is, the first one is big business. So we've got a really wide audience who listen to this podcast, from people who work in the corporate world to small business startups to those, you know, in medium-sized organizations. But the one thing that I think they all share is this narrative, this belief that business can do better. And some of them are sitting in organizations, big corporates, knowing what they want to do, but struggling to, you know, understand how they can actually start this and get traction. With your knowledge of what you're seeing in the investment world, have you got a message for them?
I would say it starts with them, because I had this conversation recently with some people inside a huge bank, and they are fantastic individuals who care, but they feel constrained by the processes and the ways of the institution. But I kind of say this all the time, as you did, like, a business isn't real. It is just people, which means it is about you just convincing people. And in the end, the person that changes the process is a person as well. So I think humanizing the whole company helps, because you realize you're not tackling a big invisible machine beast, you're actually just tackling people. I think the biggest thing I've learned, which it kills me to say it a little, is like, you become very good at kind of arguing a business case. As we talked about earlier, it's the why is this important to the company? It's not just about reputation, it's just about looking good. It is about bottom line. It's about doing good business and doing more of it. So I would say, find the allies and the people that will help you, because as we talked about earlier with collaboration, it's really hard to drive change in big companies if you are one person, but it starts with one person. So find your allies and just, yeah, get a, like, pull together a nice business case nearly, but it doesn't have to be like businessy, but the people need to know what is in it for them, what is in it for the business, around, you know, what problems you could solve simply by delivering your products to different people. Even if sometimes the smallest of changes that could have a huge impact.
Yeah, absolutely. And this idea that profit and purpose there, as you said before, that there's a trade-off, that it's binary. It's like, that's just lazy thinking. You know, there is opportunity that's sitting there. And if there was ever a time where someone within the organization would be listening, it's got to be now, right?
Yeah.
And then the other thing I wanted to ask is, how about someone who is sitting there, like, you know, they might have their own small business, but they have the power to do something. Fear may be holding them back.
I think for small businesses, it is about it's the personal fear. I would say if you've started a small business, most small businesses have started because you picked a problem that you wanted to solve that you cared about. So I don't need to go into the pick a problem that you think, you know, is important. But I would say sometimes it's worth revisiting your problem, because the biggest thing, I am so grateful for my mentors and advisors over the years, because when you build a social business, keeping the social side and the impact side can be hard. When you have board meetings where you have to report to the tax people and it's just always about the dollars, slowly over time you drift and you realize, I was writing up my quarterly summary to my board this morning, and you look at the metrics and you think, hang on a minute, I've just focused on the numbers. Are we losing the core of why we're doing this, and for who are we doing this? So as small business people, I would say always return to your why, and make sure you surround yourself with mentors, advisors, people that, like, my board meeting, I remember I used to set it up and run it, you know, a bit like it, just like a normal board meeting. And Liz Broderick, who used to be Australia's Sex Discrimination Commissioner, now is a rapporteur to the UN. She's on my board, and she is one of the best at being like, all right, agenda items are done, but like, what's the impact and how are you? And, you know, those kind of things that keep your true north. And I think it's really important, because it's easy to stray, particularly with the business side of things. But you do need to stay true to why you started this and who you're doing it for.
That is absolutely brilliant. Thank you so much for sharing that. Before we go, is there anything else you'd like to share? Anything you'd like to tell our listeners about Vested or yourself?
Only that, as I said earlier, money doesn't change the world. The people that spend it do. So actually, we as everyday people are the people that can, you know, truly make sure that the companies we support we invest in, we spend our money in, are the ones that are, you know, serving the society and the world we want to live in.
Your wallet is your vote. How can people contact you, Kim? Where's the best place to find you?
Yeah, LinkedIn, if you're on LinkedIn, is probably the best way to find me, or through our website at www.vestedimpact.co.uk.
Wonderful. And we'll include the links in the show notes. Thank you so much for coming on the show and giving us your time. I've really enjoyed learning about Vested and learning a little bit about you. Thanks, Kim.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been a great conversation.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the For Love and Money podcast. If you'd like to take a deeper dive into the purpose movement, visit us at thecauseeffect.com.au. And remember, doing good is good for business. So if you're not doing good, then what are you doing?